This is Ozarks at Large. Thank you very much for your contributions during this fundraising month. Contributions that go toward making public radio, KUAF, and Ozarks at Large continue. You can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com. Early next month, the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville will host the fourth annual Native American Cultural Celebration. It will be that V word, virtual. But the lineup of live and recorded workshops and discussions is impressive and includes a conversation with Commander John Harrington, the first enrolled member of a Native American tribe to fly in space. He was a mission specialist for the 16th Space Shuttle mission in 2002. Harrington was born in eastern Oklahoma, but his family moved away when he was young. On Friday, we reached him at his home in Montana as smoke from the western United States wildfires had reached his house. During our conversation, he mentioned that when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, he was 9 years old, and he watched the event with his family. And though as a child he played in a refrigerator box that was his imagined spaceship, he says his journey to space was not a straight line.
My first year in college, I learned how to rock climb. I met two guys out at the Garden of the Gods outside of Colorado Springs, and I would go out there because I liked the sensation of being outside. I liked being in the mountains, and I liked to scramble on the rocks. But I met two guys one day that actually had a rope on, and they were actually climbing a pretty steep climb, and I just was fascinated. And they said, you want to learn? One guy leaned over and said, hey, do you want to learn? I would say, I'd love to. So we started climbing, and I was so fascinated by it. I wanted to do it. And, of course, I would spend my time out there, not in the classroom, or not studying to the best extent possible, and was suspended for low grades. Had a 1.72 GPA. I got 3 D's in 2 semesters, and the school decided I wasn't worthy. So I got kicked out of the University of Colorado when I was a freshman for a 1.72 GPA. Yep. And but the job I had, I mean, the rock climbing I did, I was offered a job in the mountains of Colorado at Interstate 70, because I knew how to climb. They needed people that could handle ropes and rappel off the side of cliffs in Glenwood Canyon, because they were surveying to put in a 4-lane highway. And they just needed guys. I knew a guy that was a rock climber. He offered me the job, and I quit in heartbeat. I was working in a restaurant, said enough of this, and I drove to Glenwood Springs, Colorado in September of 1977. And started working on a highway with a bunch of folks that use math in their everyday life. I got to watch people actually do math and not just look at it in a textbook. That was pretty cool.
There's a couple of lessons here, right? I mean, it would have been easy with a 1.72 GPA and suspended from university to convince yourself you couldn't do other things, let alone eventually end up walking in space. I don't want to jump ahead, but it kind of shows that the final chapter hasn't been written when you might think it has been.
Oh, that's very true. I think one of the challenges we all have is what motivates us. You know, what's that thing we're going to find in life that really sparks a fire in you? And for me, it was this physical sensation and this excitement of climbing led to a job that allowed me to do, you know, something along those lines. And then in the process, you see people doing something else and you start asking questions. And I think it's that natural curiosity that we have. There's something we enjoy. You're going to ask more questions about it. And this goes back to, you know, much later in life, I work on my PhD. There's a guy named John Dewey back in the 1930s, was an educator who he found that kids were interested in those things that were most pertinent to their lives. And the idea, he started a workshop, an educational workshop in Chicago, I believe, to get kids, you know, to the motivation to get kids to learn. He was doing this back in the 30s, and it's very applicable today. And so in my PhD work, I was looking at the same thing. What motivates a child to want to study math and science? You know, what can you put in their lives that makes a difference to increase their curiosity? And that certainly is what happened for me. But it's just not that. It's there's a lot of other things going around. People, you know, mentors, people that that take you aside and say, hey, what are you going to do when you grow up? Hmm. You know, you can't do this the rest of your life. And that happened to me when I was surveying. The guy that owned the company sat me down one day in the just out of the blue and said, hey, what do you do when you grow up? You know, it was like every other kid who was 19, I thought I was grown up. I thought, I want to do this. This is fun. I said, I like this. He goes, well, you know, you can't make a living on $4 an hour. You know, what are you doing when you're 25? What are you, 30? This is not going to provide you a substantive living. So why don't you go back to school and become the engineer, be the one responsible for all this stuff. Don't just accept being, you know, the lowest paid guy on the rung of the ladder. You know, go back and become an engineer, get a college education. You know, this is how you go about doing that. And it was that, you know, that short period of time, that small, you know, push on this little kid to make the effort to apply to go back to school. And the school actually let me back in with a 1.72 GPA. I had a motivation now, and the school gave me the opportunity. And I was fortunate because that doesn't happen very often.
When you're on the space shuttle and you arrive at the station, right? You link up. Is there a sensation? Is there a sound? What is that like? We know what it's like to land, be in a plane and land, but what is it like when you've traveled that far and you've made that successful connection?
Well, there's a process. It's like you don't just get there, obviously.
Right.
There's a process. And there's a point where you look out the window and you see this really bright star. And you realize that star is you're going to that star. You're going to that bright object in the sky because you're reflecting the sunlight. And you go, and it gets bigger. And then it gets bigger. Pretty soon, you know, you're underneath it, flying up in front of it. And we're working on computers. I'm setting up the computers. They're all set up. The commander's flying the vehicle. We're shooting a laser rangefinder out the window to measure how fast we're closing in on it. And that star is now this incredible engineering facility in the vacuum of space. And you're like, wow, you know, this is, we're really here. And then when you, of course, it's really quiet. You're moving a formation at 17,500 miles an hour, but you can't tell, you know, you're doing it together. And then when you actually get the vehicle gets really close, it's out the window, and you're getting ready to dock with the docking mechanism, and you hit it, you know, the whole thing kind of shudders, you know, and you can hear the little jets when the commander's firing and flying the vehicle into it. You actually feel the jets. They kind of shudder through the structure. Hmm. And then when you connect, you're like, okay, but you can't just go, that's really cool. You got work to do. You got to retract the mechanism. You got to seal the mechanism. You got to do a leak check on the mechanism. You got to do all these things, because if you don't do all those things and you open the hatch, well, you know, a good day turns to a really bad day really quick.
Right.
And so you have this process that you have to work through. And so you have to look at it in amazement and go, wow, get back to work. You know, it's like the movie Vacation, you know, when Chevy Chase is in the Grand Canyon, his wife says, Clark, don't you want to look at the Grand Canyon? And Clark like nods twice and they leave, you know.
Right.
It's there, but you got to go. You got something to do.
You are in the Chickasaw Hall of Fame. You have Chickasaw heritage. You took the tribe's flag, a flute, and some other items with you in space?
Yes, sir. I flew the flag for the tribe. I get back to Governor Anatubby, the governor of the tribe, and then ended up also flew some eagle feathers. Mm. Eagle feather was given to me by an elder with the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, AISES, AISES. And that's a feather that was actually from the same eagle that another feather had flown to the space station on, with a guy named Ellison Onizuka. And Ellison was on the Challenger. He flew a mission, and the next mission he flew was the Challenger, so we perished on the Challenger. And I was flying a feather from that same eagle. So it was very, very, it was a very honor to have that opportunity. And so that feather now was able to actually take out and fly to photograph it, you know, over the Earth in the space shuttle. And that's now in the Smithsonian, the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C.
Wow. When you're on a spacewalk, you did three of them that almost totaled 20 minutes. Do you hear yourself breathe in that suit, that helmet?
Oh, yeah. No, it was 20 hours, actually.
20 hours, yeah. What did I say, 20 minutes? I meant almost 20 hours, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's you hear a fan. There's a fan going, and it's blowing the air over the top of your head. So you hear the mechanics of the system. But you also hear the radios. You're talking to somebody. Somebody's always listening to you. You're just chattering away. You know, with the guy you're spacewalking with, the guy inside the vehicle, or whoever's reading the checklist, whoever's running robotic arms, you're communicating with somebody. It's not dead silence. It's not this, you know, the vacuum of space. You can, no one here can hear you scream. They can, because you're on the radio. they would hear you scream. But yeah, there's always something going on. So it's not this, you know, incredibly quiet, you know, dead silence type of thing.
You've mentioned mentors and that. Do you feel a responsibility, or I don't know if that's the right word, but the connection that you have with your heritage?
Sure.
And
you think about what your ancestors gave you the opportunity to do. You're here because your ancestors survived whatever life they were living at the time. And so if you go back and look at my tribe, my Chickasaw side of my family, you look at all the things they did in their lives that their leadership did to make sure they survived. If they hadn't made decisions, you know, at the time they did, once again, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So I look back at what my ancestors gave me the opportunity to do and the decisions they made, you know, to be successful and to survive in the moment and, you know, for generations. I'm thankful they've done that because it's given me a chance to do this. And if I can do this for somebody else, you know, then I've done what they allowed me to do. One of the things that happened, let's say 2013, there was a time capsule that was buried in Oklahoma City in 1913. And one of the women that was responsible for this, getting all these artifacts together, was a Native woman, high society in Oklahoma. She was Choctaw, I think Chickasaw. Zarina was her name. Apologies, don't remember her name. But she got together a lot of artifacts, and they were not just, you know, artifacts. They were Native artifacts. There were a lot of items in this time capsule that were from tribes in Indian Territory, which became Oklahoma in 1907. So one of those things was, actually three things that are really important. One was a poster that was of a fair in Oklahoma City in the late 1800s. And on that poster, it was a hand-drawn poster, and it had a bunch of Indians dancing around the fire. And in that, it was written, "Lo, the poor Indian, whose untutored mind sees God in the clouds and hears him in the wind. Mm-hmm. Watch the primitive incantations of the primitive people of the forest dance around the fire, blah, blah, blah." That was this poster, late 1800s. So here was a depiction of Native people as a savage, uneducated people that were primitive. Okay. Right next to that poster was a printed copy of the Chickasaw Constitution, treaties and laws of my tribe. So in that same box, there's this dichotomy of, here's the untutored Indian. Oh no, wait a minute. No, here's a printed copy of their constitution and their laws. So to me, that was an incredible moment in my life to see, hey, here's one view of what Native people were, and here's what Native people were or are today. So here was this incredible for me to be able to hold in my hand a copy of my tribe's constitution, in contrast to this, you know, primitive poster.
Right.
Well, right next to all that was a letter, was an envelope, and no one had opened it yet. And I said, "Can I open this?" I had no idea what was in it. I opened it up, and it was a letter, beautifully handwritten letter to this woman, Zarina, what her name was. "Thank you for letting me do this." And it went on that he described who he was. And his name was William Malcolm Guy. And William Malcolm Guy talked about being born in Boggy Depot, back in the day, served in the Confederate Army, was like the governor of the Chickasaw Nation. And he said it was his intent, he hopes that the representatives of living 100 years hence are in full enjoyment of the opportunity he wanted to see his people reach in terms of education and success. And I'm the first person, you know, to open this letter in 100 years, and I'm a Chickasaw citizen, and I'm an astronaut. And I'm thinking, what would he think? What would my ancestor think? The guy that wrote this letter, that the first person that picked it up to read it in 100 years was a Chickasaw citizen who'd flown in space. And so I actually took that copy of that, and then I gave it to Governor Anatubby. I had it printed out, and I put it in a big frame. I said, this is what leadership's all about. This is what, you know, we as leaders need to do to make a difference in the lives of our people. And here was somebody that really, that's what he wanted for his people. And like I say, his people are in enjoyment of that now, but it's because they made the decisions back then. So this is a long answer to a short question. But I think it's important that, you know, we can honor those folks that gave us the opportunity to be here by doing the most that we can.
As you and I talk, we've entered a seventh month of a global pandemic. You mentioned you're in Montana, you're getting smoke from these record-setting wildfires. It's easy to be stressed, nervous, uncertain about these times. I'm wondering, do you think since you have been up there and looked down, that you might have different perspective about the global situation than if you hadn't gone to space?
Well, I think one of the things that being in space and being in the space station, this idea that you're isolated, you know, that we, one of the things we talk about in the pandemic is if we want to improve our chances for surviving the pandemic, you follow certain rules. You do certain things that will increase your chances of success. So astronauts, they say they take a lot of risks. Well, you know, we try and mitigate the risks that we know exist, you know, because that's what's going to allow you to survive. You know, we're like on the space shuttle or space station, there's a myriad of things that can go bad, really bad, that will, you know, will cease your existence. So we train to make sure that we can overcome those failures. We train to make sure that we can survive given certain things that happen. So if you're on the space station, you think, you know, you're in this facility that's keeping you alive. The bad stuff's on the outside. You know, the bad things are out there. If you go out there, what things will you do to decrease the risk, to mitigate the risk of you dying? Same thing being in a house or being out in public. You know, if I step out in public, science tells me that I improve my chances of not getting sick or getting somebody sick by wearing a mask, plain and simple. It's not an idea of loss of freedom. It's an idea of what the science tell us that we need to do to make a difference in the lives of others. And if we're arrogant and insensitive enough to say it doesn't matter, well, you're not, your ancestors shouldn't, you know, you've made it to a point your ancestors would be really ticked off at you, you know?
Right.
And that's what I look at, is that we have a chance to make a difference if we understand the science and believe it and look at it from a global perspective, you know, a perspective of not just me, but those around me. And I think as a crew, as people on the space station or shuttle, we don't work just for us. We work for all of us on a team. Because if we didn't do that, you can't solve a lot of the problems that arise because one person cannot do it. It takes a team effort to be able to do it. So that's a perspective I have from being an astronaut or being in the Navy or being a team player, is that, you know, I have a certain responsibility, not just to me, but to those around me. And I have a certain responsibility to accept and appreciate the people that have knowledge that I do not have, tell me what the right thing to do is. And I'm not arrogant enough to disregard that type of information, because that's just not going to do me any good or anybody else any good.
Commander John Harrington was the first enrolled member of a Native American tribe to fly in space as a mission specialist for the 16th Space Shuttle mission in 2002. He will take part in a virtual conversation hosted by the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville early next month. He'll also answer 20 questions about being in space submitted by children. Deadline for submitting a question is Thursday. More details can be found at mona.us. That's MONAH.US. We talked with him Friday by phone. He was at his home in Montana. And this is an evening edition of Ozarks at Large.